Florida, after Ian, buildings destroyed from wind and water, and a death toll that's on the rise.
We'll hear about conditions in Fort Myers and Naples, some of the hardest hit areas.
I'm Aisha Roscoe.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News.
U.S. markets continued a downward trend for a third quarter. Why? Inflation and the war in Ukraine.
But the dollar's gotten stronger. Here's Rukshir Sharma of Rockefeller International.
The United States is the predominant financial superpower of the world, and people are rushing to hold their assets in U.S. dollar cash.
And student loan relief? Not so fast. Republican-led states are suing to stop President Biden's program.
So please stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend. Hurricane Ian has weakened to a post-tropical storm after making a second landfall in South Carolina yesterday. Crews are working to restore power to tens of thousands of people there.
As they are in Florida, where more than a million people are still without power, 3 days since the storm slammed into that state.
So far, officials say more than two dozen people have died because of the storm, but expect that number to increase as recovery efforts continue.
NPR's Martin Costi has been talking to people who live around Fort Myers and Naples and joins us now. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
The pictures in the video from southwestern Florida are just horrific. Can you tell us more about what you're seeing?
Well, at first blush, what I'm seeing are a lot of people and cars around, a lot more than I expected. The roads and these highways that connect the coastal towns from Naples up toward Fort Myers are really busy. There are a lot of utility trucks going to try to repair the lines, or relief workers, but also just regular people driving around. And then that's what I think when you realize just how many people actually hunkered down here and weathered the storm. And, you know, many of them, when you ask them about that experience, they seem kind of shaken by going through that storm here. I talked to Eric Fredrickson. He was in Bonita Springs yesterday. Look at the damage there. He wrote about the storm in the region, too, up in Cape Coral in his house. That's really close to Fort Myers. And this is how he described that experience to me.
We were, what do they call it, the eye wall? Is that what it's called? We were right on that for about 7 hours. It feels like your house is going to get sucked into a giant vacuum cleaner for 7 hours straight. It's crazy.
You kind of hear in his voice there, I think there's kind of a stunned quality when you talk to people who went through that. And now they're kind of emerging from that shock, and they're kind of starting to drive around and look at what's changed in this area they call home.
And what are they finding?
Well, as he put it to me, it's kind of random in his neighborhood. For example, you know, one street, the houses seem to have come through okay. There might be a little street flooding. And then like one street over, you know, the roofs are torn off and you see a metal roof twisted around a light pole. You know, if you were in an older, smaller house, you know, that did not fare as well as the bigger, more solid buildings. A lot of them are pretty solid here, especially some of the newer ones. Florida has some pretty strict building codes, and, you know, some buildings here are pretty solid. But if you're close to the ocean surge, though, if you're close to the shore, almost didn't matter because you'd have flooding and damage anyway.
What about search and rescue efforts? Like, are those still happening?
Well, right now, they're doing what they call kind of fast preliminary checks. You know, the crew's actually running networks of drones or going out on land. They're mapping out the hazards, looking for survivors who might need help. We occasionally see military Black Hawk helicopters going back and forth out to what looks like the barrier islands. And you know, when you fly over this area, you get a sense that we might just be beginning to understand how extensive the damage is or how many people might have been caught up in it. I talked to a reporter for NPR member station here, WGCU. Her name is Eileen Kelly, right after she did a helicopter flight over Fort Myers. This is a place she knows very well. And she described the scene that she saw from up there like this.
Any one-story place is gone.
Blocks in.
Yes, blocks, like from ocean to bay. And it's horrifying because the water is generally green in the summer, and it's black now. It's black with some copper tones in it. And then off in the distance, you see the green. And it's clear that it's oil and gas in there from the boats.
It is, you know, mind-boggling the amount of cleanup and recovery that is going to be needed. It's hard to wrap your mind around that. What signs of, you know, just cleanup, recovery have you been seeing so far?
Well, it's real early days, but there are definitely people here trying to get going. You know, there are restaurants with generators serving food, people lining up outside hardware stores to kind of get started on what they need to do. Things are in motion, but there's no doubt this is going to take, well, frankly, years for this to look like it did before.
That's NPR's Martin Costi reporting from Southwest Florida. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Fiscal year begins today, and it's been a rough year for Wall Street.
Not just stocks, which are in a bear market, but bonds, commodities, currencies, except for the dollar.
NPR's David Gura joins us now. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, Scott.
Help us understand how far the markets have fallen.
Well, it's been a pretty steady march downward since the start of the year, and the declines really started steepening in March when the Federal Reserve began hiking interest rates aggressively to get high inflation under control, and it's raised them five times so far. So the third quarter, which just ended, was not pretty. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by almost 9%, and the month of September was not great. I'll note that historically, September is the cruelest month for markets. In September, on average, the S&P 500 has fallen by about 1%. Well, this September, it fell by about nine times that. I want to stress the sell-offs we've seen have not been confined to U.S. stocks alone. There have been steep sell-offs in Paris, London, Frankfurt, Tokyo, Shanghai, and we're seeing bonds take a hit, commodity prices under pressure. And as we saw this week, Scott, when the British pound fell to a record low against the dollar, currencies are also getting hammered.
David, how'd we get here?
We've got what's become the usual suspects. High inflation, of course, along with the war in Ukraine, supply chain issues. But there are some new factors making things worse. One is the strength of the U.S. dollar. That's made U.S. goods more expensive in lots of other countries, and it's weakened the value of other currencies because demand for them has dropped. The second thing is new uncertainty around the Federal Reserve's fight against high prices. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has a new mantra, and it's, "We will keep at it until we are confident the job is done." He said that several times in recent remarks. And what that means is the Fed is committed to getting inflation under control no matter what. And the reason that worries Wall Street is the Fed has made it pretty clear it's okay with that causing some pain, with there being more layoffs, with there being higher borrowing costs, which has added fuel to fears the Fed is going to trigger a recession. And one more thing, Scott, many investors are having a hard time getting a handle on the Fed's approach now, given it is so different from what it was not too long ago.
Well, how does this approach compare to the past?
Yeah, it's radical. I mean, professional investors keep telling me there's a new regime. That's the phrase they all use. You know, Wall Street got used to a world in which inflation was really low and interest rates were really close to zero. It cost next to nothing to borrow money. Michael Purvis is the CEO of Taubach & Capital, and he says in the last year, the landscape changed dramatically, and the Fed has done a 180.
That kind of abrupt shift from the world's most important central bank means that you're going to get volatility in asset classes. And I don't know if this volatility is going to really let up anytime soon.
Wall Street has to recalibrate its expectations, he says, and investors need to see something in the data, in how the Fed characterizes the data, that makes them feel less pessimistic about where the U.S. economy is headed.
David, 3 months left in the year. Do you foresee things improving?
Well, there aren't many hopeful signs. We will keep a close eye on the data for signs inflation is starting to slow down, but so far we're not seeing that. New data on Friday showed inflation was higher than expected. That was according to the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. And beyond that, jobs numbers for September come out next week. We'll see if there are signs of a hiring slowdown. And also important is what companies are saying. Nike just announced sales dropped in China, and it continues to have supply chain issues and too much inventory. Apple is reportedly going to scale back iPhone production. We want to see how companies have navigated all these difficulties, from high interest rates to weakening demand. But most importantly, Scott, in quarterly reports, we'll learn how these companies are feeling about the future and how they're planning for it.
NPR's David Gura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Biden's efforts to cancel up to $20,000 per person in federal student loan debt was hit by a number of lawsuits this week, one on Tuesday, two more on Thursday.
And NPR's Corey Turner says additional lawsuits are likely in the coming weeks. He's here now to talk about that. Good morning, Corey.
Hey, Aisha.
So who's filing these lawsuits and why?
Well, they're coming from a range of conservative politicians, interest groups, attorneys, and they've been really clear. They think Biden's loan relief plan is an illegal abuse of power. They say Congress controls government spending, not the president, and Biden can't simply erase hundreds of billions of dollars in student loans without going through lawmakers. Here's Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich behind one of those Thursday lawsuits.
The president isn't a king. He's not an emperor. And if he does something unconstitutional, hell yeah, I'm going to hold him accountable.
How is the Biden administration responding to these lawsuits?
Well, twice this past week, the U.S. Department of Education subtly shifted its debt relief plan, essentially trying to undercut these legal challenges. So first, it announced borrowers could opt out of debt relief, and that came after a lawsuit from a borrower who claimed he would be harmed by automatic debt relief. And then on Thursday, Aisha, the department quietly changed the rules around borrowers who hold these old federal loans called FEL loans. It stands for Federal Family Education Loans. And the change came at the same time as a lawsuit arguing that erasing a lot of these loans would actually hurt the private banks and state agencies that manage them. See, Biden's original plan allowed these FFELP borrowers to consolidate their loans into new federal loans and then qualify for cancellation. But on Thursday, the administration very quietly changed that, saying these borrowers no longer qualify.
That is a big change. Like, can you tell us about these borrowers who are suddenly going to be excluded from getting loan relief?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to note here is that these are often really vulnerable borrowers because the FFELP program ended in 2010, so 12 years ago, at least. Sarah Turner is a higher ed economist at UVA and saw that she tweeted that this kind of old debt is disproportionately held by people attending community colleges, historically Black colleges and universities, and for-profit colleges. And you know, I've seen a lot of frustration on social media and in my email inbox from borrowers who are suddenly trying to come to grips with the fact that they don't qualify for cancellation, even though they had been told they would.
Do you have any idea how many people will be excluded by this change?
Yeah, this is a really tough one. There's a lot of educated guesswork. We know there are roughly 4 million of these borrowers with old FFELP loans, but the administration insists it won't affect nearly that many. An administration official told me they think it's closer to 800,000. Personally, though, I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, and we just don't know yet.
So is there anything else that these borrowers should know?
Well, the Education Department insists it is still exploring other legal options to help them. Not sure how much stock to put in that. I should also say some FFELP borrowers out there may still qualify for a limited expansion of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. They do still qualify for that until it expires at the end of October.
So, Corey, should we expect to see more changes like this in the coming weeks, you know, in response to legal battles?
I mean, Aisha, I've been thinking of this process now like a kind of awkward dance where a lawsuit pops up pursuing a specific legal strategy, and then the Ed Department responds to protect itself, you know, as best it can. And I think what's really surprising at this point is that the department didn't actually tailor its plan more from the start. You know, I can tell you, I have talked with a lot of higher ed experts and lawyers this past week who say, look, these legal arguments should have been obvious long before this plan was even announced.
That's NPR's Corey Turner. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
And that's Up First for Saturday, October 1st, 2022. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
And I'm Scott Simon. Up First is back tomorrow with a story about one man's struggle with homelessness in New York City and how he managed to find stability. You can follow us on social media. We are at Up First on Twitter.
And for more news and interviews, books and music, look us up on the radio.
Yeah, weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings. You can find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.